Henry Mancini. Sunday night, then that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 180th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 179 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13.com. As I've said for the last 5 months, my last piece for West of the Guardian, the 212th, is still available. That website, www.westoftheguardian.com, that is hopefully left up there to be read by every living American. And I, of course, hope that they do. It's the last of the Credit Disruption series in the paper, as the paper has, unfortunately, after the September 29th issue, joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal of America, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue that I referenced also contains columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and well-known critic John Simon. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, technology, books, the environment. But the real focus on presently the opinion in a divided country, then artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead. Try it and subscribe. It's free, only one email per day. Then once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Next week, my guest will be the poet laureate of the state of Missouri, Professor Kiki Barnstone. I hope you'll join us not only tonight and next week, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday night, either live or as most to listen later. Before getting into tonight's show, I've had something on my mind for the last 24 hours. Yesterday, while in the supermarket, I ran into a friend who was a professor at both the local four-year college and the two-year community college. She mentioned that the Muslim student of hers, while on the bus, had had the gun placed to her head and was told to get out of the country. She also said that the number of Hispanic students at the community college are traumatized because their parents are in danger of being deported. They are not, as they were born here. We talked briefly also about the desecration of Jewish cemeteries and community centers, all very troubling occurrences. Many opponents of President Trump blame all this on him, and in the case of the fear of deportation, they're of course correct. But his election didn't create all of the bigoted people engaging in anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic behavior. The election may have unleashed it, but the bigotry and hatred had to be there to begin with. But I think that we must try to understand the origins of such societal cancer and find ways to eliminate it. Now, to this week's show, the 180th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. Now, my guest tonight is writer, editor, and ghostwriter Laura Bounds. I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Kilty. Laura is a Facebook friend who has lived in Middle America throughout her life, Ohio, Colorado, Wyoming, Michigan, and back to Ohio. She has seen Bigfoot, been a dental assistant, a licensed dental technician, owned a dental laboratory, and taught school. All of this before embarking on the writing and publishing career. Her writing has appeared in print and online journals, and in addition to editing and ghostwriting, she's the co-owner of an online publishing company. She has the novel In Progress, then holds the bachelor's in English literature and the master in fine arts in fiction. Wow, that wears me out. We'll discuss all aspects of Laura's interesting life on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Laura, I gave a brief overview of your life in this lead, and there is much to discuss as we flesh out the details. So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town called Reynoldsburg, Ohio, which is about, I'd say, 30 miles from Columbus. People usually know where Columbus is, but not Reynoldsburg. Lived there all my life until became an adult and then started roaming, I guess you would call it, Wyoming, Colorado, Michigan, and then back to Ohio.
Were you interested in riding as a young child?
I was. I guess I've always been a reader, and ever since I could pick up a book, I've been reading. But I think what really, the writing bug really bit me when I was in fourth grade and entered a story contest. And I happened to win that story contest and got to present my story in front of an assembly. And just the fact that people would listen to, you know, something I wrote really, really touched me in a way that never really let me go. So went off to a practical life after that, you know, graduating from high school and all of that, but never really gave it up. I was hooked early on and kept at it.
Where did you go to grammar school?
Grammar school, that would have been French Ron Elementary in the old part of Reynoldsburg. And then about fifth grade, I moved to a different part of town and went to a little local school named Herbert Mills. And met a lot of people around town, so I knew a lot of different kinds of folks.
And then off to high school in the same town or another town?
Same town, Reynoldsburg High School, right there on Livingston Avenue. Still have many of my old friends from Reynoldsburg. I've reconnected since moving back. And, we live quietly now in Pickerington, which is right next door.
In your bio, you described a rebel without a cause 10 years, even more so after the death of your father. Was this the norm in your community, or were you pushing the edge of the envelope?
Probably pushing the edge of the envelope. Like many artists or writers, great curiosity, kind of I would describe it as maybe scuffed around kid syndrome, especially after the death of my father. Very curious, attracted to trouble. If I wasn't in it, then I was on the fringes watching. And then I'd go home and write a poem about it. always riding the edge of the envelope.
After some unwise acting out, you entered into your ongoing 30-year marriage, but you had some wild experiences early on with your husband, getting lost owning the six-pack to nourish you and meeting Bigfoot and making the front page of the Denver paper because of your skiing skill. Please tell us about all of these and more.
Well, I met Greg, and that's my husband, and he was trouble, but trouble of a different kind, I'd say. Took me out west. We took off together. He was a bit of a rebel in his own family as well, and so we went off to have adventures out west and ended up on a on a ranch, believe it or not, in Walden, Colorado. And he got a job there on the ranch. And the plan was is to stay through the winter, and he would take care of the cow herd. Being from Ohio, pretty much the suburbs of Ohio, we didn't have many cows there, but my grandparents did own a farm, so I liked visiting there when I was younger. But anyway, takes me out to Walden, Colorado, and got me lost on Cameron Pass with nothing but six beers and a pulled muscle. So, he was trouble, but trouble of a different kind. And we lived there in a trailer for about 8 months until I drank some unpasteurized milk and pretty much got so sick I thought I was going to be hospitalized and thought, I have to get out of here. So I drove across the pass and found a job in Breckenridge, Colorado, which is the ski town. Worked in the dental office there while he did ski school, was an instructor, and lived there and fell in love and came home and got married and lived back in our hometown for about a year before we took off again to Wyoming after the birth of my first child, Chelsea.
Now, where did Bigfoot come in?
Well, he was in Walden. And I don't know if it's Bigfoot or not, but I'm swearing to this day it was Bigfoot. As we're sitting in our trailer one night, really late at night, he'd been working all day. We had no TV. I'd read every book in the library. We're sitting on the couch side by side, and all of a sudden I see eyes shine out the back of the trailer. So I turned around really slowly to look right at it, and then the thing snorted a couple of times. But I must say we smelled the thing before we heard the thing. Well, we kind of, you know, it was really scary. I ended up on his lap. The next morning we go out to see if we could find any tracks or anything in the mud back there behind the trailer, and we discovered that that window was about, I'd say, 8 or 9 feet off the ground. So whatever animal that was out there was pretty big. So that's our Bigfoot story.
And what about the front page of the Denver newspaper because of your seeing skill?
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. Flatland, Ohio. Never been skiing before in my entire life, but my husband had. So he takes me to skiing Breckenridge. Here I am going down a blue run, my first time on skis, hitting the tops of every mogul on the way down. I get to the bottom. Thank God I made it. And a reporter from the Denver Post walks up and saw my spectacular downfall down the mountain and asked me why I kept doing this. So I had to explain to him. I thought I could. You know, I could do anything at that age, or so I thought. And, I made the front of the Denver Post because of my poor skiing ability. In one piece, though.
After your daughter was born, as you mentioned, you moved first to Jacksonville, Wyoming, and then to northern Michigan. What prompted the move, and how did you wind up adjacent to an Amish community in dairy farming land in Michigan?
Oh, boy. That's many years making, but we'll try to condense it for you. We moved back home and got married, and we now live about a mile from where we were married so many years ago, which is strange because I never thought we'd end up back where we started, but we did. I had my daughter. He was finishing up with school at that time, and I was working in a dental office here in Pickerington for a doctor, Dr. Voigt, who ended up going to school with my son. His son ended up graduating with my son, but anyway. So he decides he wants to take us back out west to Wyoming after we had a farm market that we ran for a few years during the drought. So that didn't end up too well, and we decided we're going to take off back out west and ended up in Jackson Hole, where I, again, worked in a dental office while my husband taught people He was in ski school there as well. And then as Chelsea started getting a little bit older, we stayed out there for maybe a year. We started thinking, we got to get this together and, you know, find out where we need to be. So my husband went back to school. We moved back home, and he went back to Ohio State. And then his uncle ended up hiring him in northern Michigan from there. So that was the move to northern Michigan happened after he got his first real job, we'll say.
So you mentioned his name is Community. How is that different to your experiences? And were you writing all along during your various locations? Were you writing for yourself?
I am. I'm writing for myself, keeping journals, making up stories. All the while, all these experiences end up on the page somewhere. And, Greg's uncle hired him in a little place called McBain, Michigan, is where we ended up settling up there. Beautiful place, dairy farms everywhere, lots of Amish people around. Really some soul searching going on during that time, because here I am, you know, from the suburbs of Ohio and, you know, thrust into this completely different community without a support system of, you know, any size. His uncle and his aunt were up there, but no mom, no sisters, no anything up there. Really did some soul searching and started writing seriously, I would say, up there. Getting in touch with my spirituality, all of that stuff.
You returned to school to be a certified dental laboratory technician, and you later opened your own lab. What brought on that career move?
Well, I'd always enjoyed working in the mouth, believe it or not. I went to vocational school during high school. College wasn't in the cards for me with my father's death, and I had a more practical-minded mother, and she did push me to get a vocational training, and I'm happy for that. It saw me through for many, many years there. Had done just about every job there was to do in the dental office. Receptionist, manager, consultant, did the books, worked chair side, did everything I could possibly do without going back to school before I went back to school. And I ended up wanting to do dental lab tech work because I really enjoyed the artistic aspect of it. It appealed to me to work. I work pretty well on my own, self-motivator kind of person. So I practiced my craft and got pretty good at making crowns and bridges, and enjoyed doing that for several years there in Michigan while I raised my kids.
What was involved in setting your own lab? Was it expensive to start off, or how did you do that?
Well, yeah, really not so expensive when you compared it to other small businesses that you could get into. Like, we thought about maybe a Dairy Queen or something like that getting into, and this was, I would say back then it was probably, I'm thinking about $100,000 investment to set up the lab and get, you know, the casting machines and the porcelain ovens and the hand pieces, everything that's involved with that and the space. And, I really enjoyed that work. And it was flexible. I could work at night after the kids were home from school and my husband was home. But he did work out of state a lot, travel a lot with his job. So pretty much me and the kids holding down the dental lab for a while while he was off doing what he needed to do. So, it was a good vocation for me and relatively inexpensive to get into.
Speaking of your time in northern Michigan, you mentioned in your note to me some interesting recreational activities in the area. Please tell the audience about them.
Oh, sure. My kids were skiing before they were 3 years old. Strapped a pair of skis on them and started taking them down the mountains, or hills, actually, compared to out west. But they thought it was big stuff, and it was fun. And we did some canoeing down the Pine River there. Lots of mushroom hunting, water sports, boating, all of that stuff. we lived where other people liked to vacation. So that's what pretty much what we did.
What was this pig chasing all about?
Oh, boy. McBain has a, they probably still do, they had a McBain Days Festival. So everybody in the small town would end up on our one, you know, they had one main street going through town, and they'd have pig chasing, and if you caught the pig, you got to keep it. So I secretly hoped, although I didn't tell my children, that they never caught that pig because I didn't want to raise a pig. But one time we really did get into a pickle because my son grabbed the back legs of the pig, but somebody else tackled it. And I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to have a pig. So, yeah, lots of fun stuff, watermelon eating contests and firemen fights where they get the hoses out and lots of fun stuff like that for kids. Rodeo, lots of fun.
And after 15 years, it was back to Ohio. What brought on your most current move?
Well, you know, you've got my mother was aging, and I kind of worried about her and wanted to be close to her before it was too late, having the, you know, lost my father at such an early age. You start getting protective of your parents like that, and both of our families are here. So as our kids started getting older, I kind of wanted to, them to experience more of a city life because I had experienced both. And so we moved back here to do that for them, better schools, the whole deal.
What were you able to do?
Sheltered.
What were you able to do with the laboratory business?
We sold it in pieces before the move, and I did keep some of the instrumentation here and worked out of the basement of my home for a little while for some local dentists because I knew practically all the dentists in town here. I'd worked for them or consulted with them at some point or the other before I left town, so it was a real easy kind of slide in. Did some commission work for some local laboratories as well, and then decided I didn't really like having the lab in the house, and I really liked teaching. I started teaching dental assistants at some point upon our return and enjoyed that for a few years before I decided to go back to school at Ohio State.
What
and,
made you
English was the natural for me.
What made you after being in the technical track in high school and then not being on, I guess, the college track, made you decide to go into formal academic education with an English major? I was an English major, by the way.
I'll tell you. Oh, well, hi. We all do end up in this arena somewhere, so I'm not surprised. English was always my first love, reading and writing and all of that. But I never really thought that was for me because, you know, coming from the place that I came from, we weren't, you know, poor, to say, I would say lower middle class. I just always tended to pick a more practical track for myself. So when given the opportunity, I really liked teaching the dental assistants, but I wanted more. So I thought maybe English, more of an opportunity to teach. And after I started, I just could not leave the creative writing alone. Studied a lot of philosophy as well, comparative studies in religion and that kind of thing. Kind of I guess I'm a person who needs to know why, and I work problems out on the page is what I do with my writing, I'd say.
Now, you mentioned that. Then you did some academic teaching and you went on for master's in fine arts. How long did you teach for?
Oh, I started teaching developmental English in 2007. And I think the last class I taught was probably, I'd say 2012. So off and on with adjunct work with the same two schools, Zane State in Zanesville, Ohio, as well as OU, the satellite college there in Zanesville as well. And it was easy because both schools are located right next door to each other. So I could do two classes at one school and one class at another, or, you know, vice versa, to kind of fill up a schedule for myself.
When did you actively begin to pursue a writing career and attempt to be published?
Right. That would be, I took the GRE for Ohio State to try to get into graduate school there. And it had just been too many years since I had taken a math course. Could not pass that GRE. Tried once and kind of, you know, lost heart with it. But then started looking into low residency schools and found Spalding University and really liked their mission statement. It seemed very non-competitive, just a place to work, to improve your craft. And so I applied and was very pleased when I was accepted and began to, you know, go to residencies that last about 11 days twice a year. And I thought I could do that and keep up with the online work and work with a mentor. And it sounded just like so much fun to me that when I got in, I jumped both feet. Got my first publication actually prior to graduate school. I think it was 2010, maybe 2011. I'm not real sure. But anyway, it was just thrilling to me that somebody thought something I wrote was worthy of publication. So, yeah, the bug bit me hard, and I went for it, and really have never looked back. I haven't taught a class, decided to carve out a writing life for myself, and I've written a lot. Since then, I live a happy life.
Has it all been short stories, or do you do any poetry also? I know that you're presently working on the novel, but I believe that's your first. What was the other? Did you do any poetry? Was it all short stories?
No, didn't do any poetry. Poetry was kind of, I don't know why, but I was kind of standoffish with the poetry. And I am about flash fiction, too. It seems like you have to accomplish so much and such a little space that it's kind of intimidating for me. But actually, I started with a novel, which remains unfinished somewhere on my laptop. But once in a while, I'll pull that thing out and work on it some more. I've written several novels for other people now as a ghostwriter. But, yeah, my first real serious attempt at novel writing is in the works as we speak.
I find short story writing to be the hardest. I have written novellas and I've written poetries and I've written a bunch. But but short stories, to me, you have to both set the scene, develop the characters, kind of a story, all in the limited space.
Right.
Now, you, on the other hand, started with the short story and you haven't done the other work. So it's just interesting, different approaches.
Yeah. Well, I actually started with that novel, and one of my mentors suggested that I try short story. The way she described me was that I was somebody that needed to know everything up front because I was always pushing the limits of my skill set, working with time right away. It seemed to me that most of my stories used the past to inform the present, which is a special structure, as I found out later in my research, described by writer Joan Silver in her craft book, The Art of Time and Fiction. It's a switchback structure, and I just was fascinated with the hows and the whys of that particular structure. Because most of the stories that I had in my head really did depend on present and past to be told. So, like my mentor said, I wanted to know everything up front because some of those moves you make are kind of tricky, especially for a new writer to attempt. So she helped me a lot by bringing me down to the short story so we could practice many techniques at once, so that I could get the stories inside my body and brain to come out onto the page the way I envisioned it when I started. So, I work with time a lot with my short stories. And I also am kind of fascinated with the passive voice right now. And when is a good time to use the passive voice in writing? And I have found that there are places that nothing else will compare to the passive voice. When you have a passive character that you're trying to write, of course, they're going to talk and speak in a passive way. But you don't want to bog your story down with the passive voice. So I'm playing with that in my work currently, adding another layer or texture to the work.
It's interesting how things happen. My the very large majority of my writing has been nonfiction, writing about technology and the impact on it. And over the years, and I've written over 2,000 articles and columns and everything. But I was not only hadn't I written any poetry ever, I hadn't read a poem since I graduated from college. I left that all behind me. And I happened to be walking through my local Barnes & Noble, where I hang out when I'm not teaching or working around the house. And I saw the title of the book by Charles Bukowski, which interested me. It was kind of a wacky title, so I picked it up. And I said, hey, this guy's crazy. I can do this, you know. So So when I had an opportunity, there was a column in the motorcycle magazine, and I liked the quote from it where talking about the brain, something like the brain sets an agenda, but the body can't carry it out. So I wrote a poem about it, and I put it away, and then for some reason I sent it into the national contest, and I forgot all about it. And about 6 months later, another writer called me up and said, "Hey, you won fourth prize in this contest." And I said, "What?"
Okay.
So and the fourth prize was $25 and a subscription to Poets and Writers magazine, and it was in their anthology, but that was either one of the best things or one of the worst things that happened to me, because that started me off, you know, and I just was writing all the time, you know. And I just started getting back to some short stories, but I still find that harder than either nonfiction, than either a novel or poetry. We'll see what happens.
I read a lot, quite a bit of poetry lately. I have lots of poet friends, and I read their work. The only real, you know, established classical poem, I guess, that caught my interest back in, the college days was Eliot's The Wasteland.
Okay.
And that grabbed me. It really grabbed me. The imagery in there really grabbed me. And it told a story. So I would say narrative poetry is probably my favorite type of poem. I don't know a whole lot about them, but I do enjoy reading them. They just seem so condensed and difficult to master to me.
An American expat, T.S. Eliot. Mine's very minor league. It's just what I want to write about, and I try to end with the humorous or a sarcastic ending, and it's just free form. But it's interesting because there are some terrific poems. By the way, there's a woman in Toledo, Ohio, who's been a guest, Lorraine Cipriano, and she has an organization of women poets, and she's publishing from them. I don't know, but you've come across it on Facebook. But she's extremely interesting, and she's a very hard worker. She tends to write short poetry, and she belongs to different organizations of women writers.
Right. I'll look her up. It's always like pleasurable to go and read somebody or listen to somebody local who's doing a reading, and I like to do that when I can. Support the local artist kind of mentality here. But yeah, thanks for the reference there. I'll look her up.
Tell us a little about some of your writing. Where have you been published? And how much? Sure.
I've had a few publications in my time that aren't ghostwrites, so I have to be careful there because of non-disclosure agreements and things of that nature. But as far as my own writing under my own name, I've been in some literary journals, and I guess my first one is called No One From Nowhere, and it won 7th in a 6-fold contest in 2015. It's probably the most recent one, but it was published there under the name of Some Terrible Beauty. 30 Years in the Hole was published at Blaze Fox, which is an online publication. I've got a story called Big Time in 94 Creations Literary Journal. I think that was in 2012. Pheasant in the Bush by Newfound Literary Journal is another one. My first publication was called My Life as Mrs. Murphy, and it's about a murderous mother. Kind of have a Stephen King, Edgar Allan Poe bend to most of my writing. And then these are all stories that are included in my collection that I'm working up at the moment, which also won the Blotter Magazine's short story and novel length, book length collection. I placed in that competition in July of 2014. So I'm a lazy submission person, and people don't get to read it unless I submit, so I make myself do this. But I'm coming up on having the short story collection completed, and I've started shopping it around a little bit, looking for agents, that kind of thing, to get it out there and let people read this collection. It's kind of a dark literature type of collection, linked stories with recurring characters, kind of a novel and stories kind of collection about working class people with real urgent problems. And you have to look, but there's this ribbon of white that runs through the different stories. And if you follow this ribbon of light that I've written in these very traumatic, traumatizing stories of mothers suffering through lower middle class type of life in America, you'll see the light and how it works and how women help women along the way, overcoming obstacles and hope on the horizon kind of short story collection.
Can we find your publishing history on a website someplace?
You can find it on www.laurahilty.com. I do have a website, and I try to keep it up to date, and hopefully we'll be adding more to that publication list soon.
And for the audience, Laura is Laura, and Hilty is Hilty, and I will publish the website when I write the article about the show. By the way, there's a very good review of the short story collection in today's Sunday New York Times Book Review, The World to Come, stories by Jim Shepherd, and they talk about his past things and how good a short story writer he is. How'd you get into ghostwriting? And how hard was it to submerge yourself into another's persona?
Right. I think I'm a good listener, and the ghostwriting came about probably out of necessity, a desire to write for a living. So, you know, some of these freelance sites like Freelancer or Guru, those kinds of websites that people advertise for somebody to write for them, basically. So it's a good way to pick up some extra money when you're trying to be a writer full-time. And so I started just taking clients from there, and I screened them pretty well. I don't like to I like the creative writing rather than, you know, the business writing kind of thing or the article writing, nonfiction kind of thing. So I was very selective in the clients that I picked when approached. You kind of just, you know, lay out your credentials and apply to jobs, and I've gotten quite a few clients from doing that. As a matter of fact, one of my clients, we collaborated really on his concept, my writing skills and developing scenes and, you know, going back and forth, a kind of collaboration. We've gotten to the point now where we want to write a few more books together. So I think we're going to join forces, and we'll each have co-writing credit on the works that are coming out. And I'm really excited about this first book that we have completed together, kind of a YA kind of reimagining of life after death and what happens there in a very sweet way.
I always think of ghostwriting being the ghostwriters working on some famous person's memoir. I didn't realize there was much ghostwriting in the fiction world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of people have really good ideas that really don't have the skills to put them on paper or know the difference between scene and summary or blending the two, dialogue and how important all of those, you know, writing elements are to a finished work. So it is very strange to listen to someone's vision and try to pull out what's in their brain to use as a story and put it into a structure and make a story from it. You really have to be a listener and really guide them into telling the story that they want to tell to the world. Very intimate kind of writing, and I don't think it's for everyone. And I didn't even really think it was for me at first until I tried it. And it's really very freeing when your name's not going to be on it. It frees you up in a different way than knowing that your writing is going to be reflected with your name on it, you know. So I found it liberating in an odd way. And I've never really been into this arena for any kind of notoriety for myself. I just really enjoy the art of writing, but we do have to make a living doing it if we're going to exist in this world, right? So this was my way of making a little bit of cash for myself and doing what I love to do.
Now, then does the person who nominally wrote it have an agent, and the agent markets it, or do you do it on a straight fee, no matter what happens to the book, or do you share in the proceeds? How does it work?
All of it's a little bit different, depending on what the client needs. Most of the time, I go into it thinking that, okay, I'm going to devote my time to this until we're finished or have a milestone completed, and usually charge by the page. Sometimes I have a client who comes back with me and wants to get it ready for publication, and I still let go when we're finished with that. You know, I just really get invested with the people that I work with, and I want to do a good job for them and represent their vision well. But once in a while, you'll run into somebody who wants to continue the collaboration, and then you kind of can negotiate for what you want from the experience. So with this latest person, we've completed one book together, and he's wanting to write a few more, so we work well together. Lots of stimulation over creation going on, and I enjoy that, working closely with someone to present a novel that we can both be proud of. So hopefully this time I'll get writing credit on this one.
It's interesting how how these things just happen to work out. The fellow that I've had on the show is he's a mystery writer. He's very, I like his book, Andrew Gross. He had his family had a successful commercial business doing something. He had a good education. He was active in the business, and he was making significant money. And he wanted to write. So at some point, he gave up the commercial work, and then he was writing, and he'd done all sorts of things, and it had reached a point, though, that he was a little despondent, and because it wasn't working out, he wasn't able to get anything sold, and he's thinking, am I really doing the right thing? I've got a family and all this. And the phone rings, and he picks up the phone, and the voice says, will you accept the call from James Patterson? So he says, sure. It turned out that Patterson's publisher was a fellow who Patterson talked to, and Patterson said, I'm looking for a writer that has a good voice for women. And the publisher said, yeah, it's a coincidence. I have this book here that we're not going to publish, but the author has he writes very well in a woman's voice. So Patterson calls him, and they wind up doing 6 books together. And by that time, the fellow has his own name, and then he goes off and he does his own mysteries, and they sell well. And it just happened that, as very often, some strange thing happens, and when you're ready, the phone rings, you know. And I thought it was a wonderful story.
We all want one of those.
Speaking of publishing, tell us about your publishing venture. What is it? How'd you get into it? And how is it moving along?
Oh, it's moving along. It's fairly new. We started in January, and it's myself and 2 friends from graduate school. And what we saw happening on Amazon was a lot of people self-publishing. And disappointment when you think a book is going to really be, you know, presented well and you're interested in the subject matter, and you look at the first page and there's, you know, a lot of editing mistakes, or it just sounds wonky when you start reading. And, you know, the e-book kind of thing is kind of flooded with a lot of people that want to get on there, you know, and are cash-driven and are buying, you know, stories from other people, and they're not well edited. So what we decided to do is just to put our heads together, start publishing authors that we're interested in, that we think write well, and tell a simple story, work with them to get the finished product professional. And we've got them up on Amazon right now. We've got 3 writers in our stall right now, romance, one fantasy writer. We've got some essays coming, and a couple of trilogies that we're thinking about offering through Amazon after the process is over. So, yeah, I'm doing writing stuff all the time, and I'm really loving life and what it has to offer in this arena now.
The thing that a lot of people don't understand when they say that they'd much rather have a traditional publisher, which most people would, is that
right.
the traditional publisher no longer does anything for you other than put the book out, unless just Stephen King or James Patterson. You have to promote it for yourself. You have to get your own publicity. You have to do whatever is necessary, your own book signings.
Right.
And it's... We just aren't used to this. I know I had 2 friends a number of years ago, and one is my oldest friend. He had been a Newsweek's Vietnam correspondent during the war, one of their correspondents, and he wrote this book about Panama, the whole story, and he interviewed Noriega, and he did all sorts of things, and the New York Times gave this terrific review, and it was published by through the lead editor, Simon Finchuster, and had this great book party, and other friends, also through Simon Finchuster, John Markoff, who drives the technology column to New York Times, he and his then wife did something called Cyberpunks. It was about hacking and hackers, and they would advise to spend their own money, hire their own publicist, and they were on the Today Show. They were on all sorts of things. My friend was on an FM station from Albany and an FM station in Washington that I happened to be there when he was on. So very, very few books after this review of the Times was the best that I've ever seen on this kind of book. And the other people did very well because they were once they had the publicity, they were on the front row in the bookstores. They were all over the place, you know. And so
wow.
it's the kind of thing that the writer normally doesn't want to have to do, but you have to do it.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, I'm one of the worst ones. I hold on to things, thinking one more revision, you know, maybe too long before I send it out there. And then there are others I rush to, you know. Rush to accept the publication and find a T drop. It was dropped in the proof. So you have to be careful. You know, I'm not always the best judge of my own work, and I enjoy the feedback I get, you know, doing workshops and critiquing manuscripts for others and having others critique my own manuscripts. But you're right. The publicity part of the entire process is the hardest part.
Though I think the hardest part is to getting used to being rejected. I mean, we don't like being rejected,
boy.
Whether it's in a relationship or whether it's to whatever. And all of a sudden, that's why I recommend that everyone read Stephen King's book on writing, which I think is the best writing book ever written. And he talks about being rejected 27 times before he hit. But he's done it right since then, I think, you know. So you have to keep pushing the envelope, you know.
You do. You do, and you know, each time that you get one of those rejections, it's like a little badge of honor because you tried, you know. And you just keep writing and keep trying and try to get better and learn more and move on to the next project and maybe revisit an old one in a few years. So. I don't think I've ever thrown a story away. I always keep working on a story until I find publication for it, but not so diligent. And, you know, some writers I talk to say they take one day a week and they do their submissions, you know, just like clockwork, like it's a job. Today I do submissions, and tomorrow I'll open the rejections.
One of the funny things, and you've probably done this, is if you've self-published anything, and then you go in and you do the book reading at Barnes & Noble, well, one of the things you have to do is you have to buy your own books, you have to have them, and then you sign them and you give them to the cashier at Barnes & Noble, who charges them, and sometime later, 3 or 4 months, they'll get the check. And no matter how many books you sold, you'll be very surprised how small the check is, because once they take their hit, you know, you're not doing too well. But it's worth the experience because you love talking to people. How does a writer get a hold of you, and do you reject things, or do you work with them and how they might improve their writing, or do you just say, no, this isn't what we do, this isn't for us, and tell other people, yeah, that's fine. How do you work with writers?
Well, we're so new that we started with people we knew and knew their writing, had workshopped with them, and knew their writing and had worked with them before. But we do have a website coming. It's called H. Webscott Publishing. LTD, and it's myself and two other, actually Spalding graduates, that decided to do this venture. And I would imagine that you can reach us on the website when it's up, or we can give my personal email, which is lhilty, the number one, at insight.rr.com. And, I'd give it a read and give you feedback on it if we do end up rejecting it. We're looking for writers.
You'll send me all of the links and email addresses, and I'll put them in the article about the show. Then you're also working on the novel. How do you have time to fit it in, and does it take away from your short story writing or what?
Right. Well, I write every day, 7 days a week, at least 4 hours a day. Sometimes I do take a day off, but not very often. I start, feeling jittery if I don't put in my computer time. So, I'm creating at least 4 hours a day, and then I review, revise, comment on manuscripts for another 4 hours a day. Not in a row. I have to take breaks, so a lot of times I'm working late at night after the house is asleep. It's just it's more of a lifestyle than a job, I think. And I spend a lot of time working different projects. This new book that I'm working on, it's about a first joint task force operative during the 80s. A little bit different than anything I've ever written before, but not really, when you get into the human nature type of a thing. A little bit like a John Wick. We've got an anti-hero in this book. He worked the drug task force for the first joint task force that was formed under Reagan, infiltrated Pablo Escobar's ring, worked his way up. He was in charge of the distribution and sale of cocaine based on a real-life person, but I can't tell you who, working closely with this person to get this book out. And I think it's very timely with the current political system and what's happening right now. I think if people read the book and realize the types of things that were happening clear back in the 80s under conservative rule, it would be an eye-opener. So I'm really excited about this one. I think that's just about as much as I can tell you at this point about this particular write. Lots of cloak and dagger stuff going on. Interesting person and interesting book that I'm writing.
Probably the most successful anti-hero in present time is Lee Charles, or Jack Reacher. He never wants to get involved with anything. He just wants to walk around the country, and of course, trouble finds him. Obviously, he's been very, very successful. The one thing I don't understand how, since if you read the books, he's 6'4" or 6'5". He's an impressive physical specimen, and Mel Gibson played him in the movies, and Mel Gibson probably comes up to about his shoulder, So I don't know how they got away with that, but
Is it Mel Gibson or Tom Cruise? I thought it was Tom Cruise.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who was also tiny. So.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen any of the pictures of? I guess it was Boy and the Dolphin. Maybe that was the name. But it was Alan Ladd and Sophia Loren. And in the kissing scenes, he had to get up on a box.
Oh boy. Well, yeah, I think Tom Cruise is probably not as tall as he's supposed to be for that particular series or film. The Reachers have been really successful. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I really think that that John Reacher character might be a real one. So that's interesting to me.
But he's an English writer. I mean, he lives here now. He's the Brit, the only child. I don't know how that he would have that much of an insight into New York. I mean, into the United States military, but he seems to have it. So.
Yes, he does, doesn't he? Which raises my suspicion.
You mentioned the hours that you put in. I did a column on years ago with on Mary Higgins clock, and she works every morning from 6 to lunchtime, and if she has something in the afternoon, she goes and she does it if she's doing research or she's doing whatever, but
right.
If she doesn't, she goes back to work. And you know, and to her, the big success thing was you work hard at your craft, and she's obviously been successful. So she was interesting too, by going back to school the way you did. She wrote for a school paper in high school, and when she graduated from high school, she was a stewardess. And then she got married, and she had 4 kids, and her husband died. And she was writing radio scripts for there used to be things on syndicated radio like the Green Grocer and things like this that you'd short things that she wrote for.
Yeah.
And she wrote a biography of Martha Washington just to prove to herself that she could write. And then she wrote just Where Are the Children, and she sold it for $3,500 for the hardcover, but it became the summer mystery book. And with that money, she took an apartment in the New York City, and with the advance from her second novel, she enrolled at Fordham, and she was a philosophy major. She graduated either magna cum or summa cum laude, and she just felt that she needed that background to be able to carry on. Then obviously she's been successful after that. So there was some of you going back to school. So
I needed that support, I guess, and lifelong friends made during graduate school. And I was delighted that after I got rid of the got over the undergrad stuff and went on to graduate school, that I was not the oldest person in the class anymore. There were several other people there that were old too. I wasn't ancient or anything, but older than the average undergrad by the time I went back to school. That was fun. I'd do it all again.
A friend of mine who's been on the show, Bob Donahue, was a computer person, as was I, and he. He moved to New Hampshire, and in New Hampshire, if you're the senior, I don't know what the age is of the seniors. I don't know if you have to be on Social Security or it's 55 or whatever, but you get free higher education. So here's a master of fine arts, and the way I understand it is the most you can take the first semester is 2 courses, and they want to see that you're serious, you know. Then after that, he was on his own. He got the master's in creative writing, and he's been trying to work his craft. So I think he's taken too long to get rejected, but he's a bit of a perfectionist. You know. So
I can relate to that one.
I normally ask people what's next for them, but you already have laid out to what's next, both the publishing, the writing, the ghostwriting, the collaborative writing. So we've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Laura Hilde?
Well, I think we've covered it pretty well. I didn't know if I could fill up your time tonight or not. I don't think I'm as interesting as others seem to think me, but I'm honored for the opportunity to talk to you tonight.
But I think you've been terrific, and thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
For me too.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog to Medium.com, published the daily newspaper mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me about the show or about anything at John McTain. Once again, John Mac is JOHN. MSU13@gmail.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmac13, for the URLs of previous shows and a schedule of the upcoming shows. I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Professor Kiki Bonstone, and every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings. Okay, Henry Mancini, take us back off. Thanks again, Lori. You're great.
Oh, that was fun. Very fun. Thank you.
Oh, good night, everybody.